chapter 5. It's a very familiar portion of Scripture for a preacher to preach on the home. And that'll probably be mentioned a little bit this morning, but the majority of my thought today is going to be Jesus and how he loved his bride. And of course, I hope that you realize that he is our supreme example. It's hard for me to understand sometimes God loving us. Some people think they maybe deserve that love. But the more you find out about the Bible and the more you live the Christian life and you learn about the absolute righteousness of God and our unrighteousness, our sinfulness, as the song we sang just a little bit earlier and as the verses that Tim was leading us in talked about, that we're an open sepulcher. In other words, we're like a grave that has not been covered over and the body has begun to decay. That's what our righteousness is like. Isaiah said that our righteousness is as filthy rags. And so when we began to think about the love that Jesus has for his bride, sometimes it's difficult to understand because we understand mortal to mortal love. You know, I mean, you understand when maybe you met that boy or that girl for the first time, you know, and you begin to have your heart flutter back and forth a little bit, and then as that love began to grow, maybe you end up getting married, and you remember that and how that there was an attraction there. But that's mortal to mortal. That was sinner to sinner. But now we have Jesus loving us, which is unrighteousness loved by absolute righteousness. And so it's kind of difficult for us to really understand that outside of the pages of the Bible. Romans tells us that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And so it's hard to understand. A second thing in my introduction is this. Sometimes I'm a little reluctant to use this passage because there's a parallel that the apostle draws between the love Jesus has for his bride and me as a husband toward my wife. Because you see, I am so much lower in the way that I give to my wife in the way that I love my wife than Jesus is in the way that he loves the church. And so because I don't reach the mark, I fall way short, I have a tendency to want to shy away from it, but the sweet Spirit of God put this passage in the Bible. And so if I'm going to be a faithful minister when I'm directed to this passage, then I must deal with it biblically. And so, even though some of us are reluctant, we'll deal with it, and this morning will be one of those times. And also, let me just say this, Satan from the very beginning has sought to mar the family. You can go all the way back to the Garden of Eden and how that he tried to wreck and ruin that first family. And to be honest with you, he did a pretty good job. I mean, you had Eve, which was deceived, and she took part of the forbidden fruit and ate it. Because of her doing that, she would bear children, and the labor would be hard. It would be painful. And because of that, you ladies that have given birth, you've had pain when you've given birth. You have Adam, and he willfully partook of the fruit. And he died, and because Adam sinned, He plunged the whole world into sin. If you doubt that, look at their offspring. What happened with the first two brothers that were alive? You had one named Cain and one named Abel. And they were making sacrifice one day. And Abel made a good sacrifice. He offered a lamb. But Cain was considered to be the first modernist by some theologians because he was like, I don't want to offer a lamb. I'm going to offer some vegetables. But the book of Hebrews tells us that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sin or there's no forgiveness. And so he would not offer a blood sacrifice. He offered vegetables and God rejected it. And he killed his brother over it. He got mad about it. And God said, where's your brother? And he said, am I my brother's keeper? And he said, if you want forgiveness, there's a sin offering at the tent door. All you've got to do is go and sacrifice. But he would not do it. And so in that first family, you've got the mom, the dad, the husband, the wife, one of the siblings. You've got them, and basically, they fell. Satan won a victory. From that time until this day, he attacks the family. If you doubt that, you're an ostrich with your head in the sand. All you've got to do is look at the news. You've got the what we call the nuclear family under attack. And it hasn't just started in the last 2 or 3 months or 2 or 3 years. It's been going on for quite some time. You've got people today and any kind of unit, any kind of mixed up conglomeration that they want, they'll say, well, that's the family. Biblically, a family is a man and a woman and kids produced by that family, that nuclear unit. But today, you'll have two men that'll say, we're a family. Two women that'll say, we're a family. We'll have two men that will be able to adopt children, and they'll say, we're a family. And may I say that the government can say they're a family all they want, but that's not a biblical definition of a family? You and I are attacked for our position. But can I tell you that that's okay? They didn't like Jesus, and they're not going to like you if you take a biblical stand. It's not about being accepted by the world. It's about being accepted by God. And so we'll preach the Bible if nobody likes it. And we'll just simply say, this is where we stand. And so Satan has always attacked. Now, why is it important for the family to be a unit? And why is it important for families to love one another? The reason is because everything that you and I are to do is we're to try to glorify God, and that way the world can see how Christians live. It's to draw people to the Lord. If our values are different and our lives are better, people say, I want that. And so this passage, I really believe, doesn't just teach about husbands loving their wives and wives submitting to their husbands. I think it has to do with a bigger picture. The context is you take not just these few verses that I'll deal with this morning, but you take the whole chapter, and then you take the whole letter, and then you take the whole New Testament. And what is that all about? It's about pointing people to Jesus. If your family is functioning the way that it needs to function, people are drawn to Christ as a result of it. And so, I want us to look at three things this morning, just very simple. The first thing that I want us to look at this morning, I want us to ask ourselves, how did he love his bride? And I want you to just think about that for just a moment. How does Jesus love you and me? Look with me at verse 25, the first part of the verse. Husbands, love your wives. That word love is the strongest word for love in the Greek language, agape. Now, when we love, there are times when we love emotionally. We love being around each other. There's that emotional attachment that we have, and we just love that. Sometimes the love is a social type love. That's where people do their part to keep the population growing, all right? Other times you've got that love and it's just purely emotional. In other words, there's something on the inside that that you just personally need that love. And then I believe that there is a spiritual love, and that transcends and maybe includes all of the others. And so you've got that highest of all loves where that you choose to love your spouse. I can't tell you the number of times I've heard people on television, maybe from Hollywood or whatever, well, I'm not in love anymore. I just fell out of love. What they mean is that they lost that little ooey-gooey feeling that they had. And because they lost that high emotionally that they had, that they got to go find it with somebody else. But biblical love is a love that you can choose to love someone. Jesus chose to love us. And so how did he love us? There wasn't anything special about us, but he made us special. He looked down and he saw somebody that was unlovely. He saw somebody that had nothing to offer. You know, there's people that get married because it's to their benefit. I've known of men that have been married multiple times, and what they do is they would marry one lady because she had money, and then they would find somebody that liked them a little bit that had more money, so they'd get rid of the first one and go to the second one. I won't call the name, but one of them ran for president about a decade ago, all right? And so you've got people that are looking for what they can get out of it. We didn't have anything to offer. I mean, we didn't have pedigree. Who's going to have a pedigree bigger than God? We didn't have money. Who's going to have more money than God? There wasn't anything about us other than the fact that Jesus looked down and said, I choose that person. And do you know he was looking for you before you ever found him? The scriptures tell us that he loved us first. And so there was something special about it. There's something unselfish about the love. Think about that for a moment, about the unselfishness of the Lord. There wasn't a single thing that you and I can do that he needed us to do. He has no needs. He's God. But yet, he was unselfish enough where he reached out and said, she'll be mine. I'll make her my bride. Not only that, but I believe that there's sharing that was involved. The joys, the burdens that husbands and wives carry with each other. There are times when Deb will share things with me that are burdens for her. There's times when I share things with her that are burdens to me. There are times when I have my joys and I share them with her and she does the same with me. And there's that interaction, there's the sharing of our lives together. That's what Jesus does. Jesus didn't just save us and then set us over on a shelf somewhere. He saved us and we can have an interaction with him. We can have a relationship with him. And so how did he love us? He loved us by making us special when we weren't. He loved us by being unselfish and giving us things that we don't even deserve. He loved us by sharing himself. But there's a second question that I want to ask you this morning. How did he prove it? How did he prove his love? Look with me at verse 25, the latter part of the verse. Not only did he love the church, it says, and gave himself for it. Now, you think about that word gave. It has the idea of sacrifice. Now, when I think of sacrificial giving, I think of giving it all. That's what you have to think about when you think about what Jesus did. If you look at the next two verses, there's the reasons why he did it. Why did he love us and why did he give it all? Because he wanted to sanctify and cleanse it, and the word it there is a reference to the church, with the washing of water by the word. In other words, he wanted to present to himself a church that had been set apart and clean. Now, in the Old Testament, those priests would go in to the tabernacle or to the temple, and they would stop and they would wash their hands at a laver, the golden laver. And it was a ceremonial type thing because they had already gone through a ritual cleansing. They had already gone and bathed themselves in what is called a mikvah. And they had already been cleansed on the outside, but they would wash themselves ceremonially. Why? Because they wanted to be clean when they came before God. The Lord has this idea that he wants his church to be clean. He wants us to be set apart for his service. Now, why should we be set apart? Well, first of all, he is holy himself. Be ye therefore holy as I am holy, the scriptures tell us. And so, he wants to set us apart and cleanse us. Now, what does setting apart mean? It basically means that you have a person that selects you and they set you over here for a specific purpose. Did you know that every person sitting here today, God has a purpose for you? You go, I can't do anything. I don't have an education. I can't do anything. I don't have any talents. I can't do anything. I can't talk in public. Did you know that every one of those arguments really don't hold water when you get right down to it? I've known of people that could not speak in public. But yet God begins to work in them and give them something, and all of a sudden it's like they're talking when they never could do that before. You remember the story of Moses? And Moses stuttered, and God came to him on the backside of a desert. He was tending to his father-in-law's livestock. And the Lord said, Moses, I want you to go and tell Pharaoh to let my people go. And Moses said, Lord, you no, I can't talk. He stuttered. And the Lord said, well, I'll send Moses. I'll send Aaron with you, but I want you to go. And he said, just to prove it to you, he said, you know that staff that you got in your hand? Throw it down. So he threw it down. And it turned into a snake. And God said, pick it up. And Moses said, Lord, you no, I can't talk, and now I can't hear too good either. Well, sometimes we make excuses about what we cannot do. But if God enables you and calls you, he will enable you. And so he's going to set you apart for a specific job. I don't know what God's got in mind for you. There's all kind of ministries. Let me just tell you about one lady that is a member of our church. And she can't come to church anymore. But she's still doing what she can do when she can do it. And that's Miss Joyce Matthews. She played the piano at the previous place she was at, and she would just minister to those folks in song. She's now at a new place, and you know what she's doing? She's doing the same thing when she can. She's doing the best she can, trying to minister and witness to people where she's at. You and I can do the same thing if we really want to. The bottom line is, we got to want to. The Lord will set you apart to do a job, and he'll give you that job to do. It may not be pastoring a church. It may not be even teaching a Sunday school class. It could be, though, something that is unique for your ability. And so, the reason for that sacrifice is to set you and I apart and to cleanse us. But in verse 27, there's also something he wants to do, that he might present it to himself a glorious church. In other words, he wants to take and he wants to cleanse and set apart so that when that bride comes forth, she's going to be glorious. Now, what does a wedding look like in our culture? Usually, if it's here in this auditorium, we'll have the preacher and the bride, the groom and the best man over here. The bride and her dad, or whoever's going to be giving her away, will usually be right outside of that door, or maybe over in the bride's room for a while until the timing, and you've got a coordinator that, you know, is telling people now, that type of thing. I'll lead the groom out and the best man out, and we'll stand down front, and then all of a sudden the back doors will open, and I'll have him turn and look, and what's he doing? His bride is being presented to him. You know, and usually, whenever the bride's coming down the aisle, usually the groom is looking, you know, like a mule eating briars. He's got a big old smile on his face, all right? She's being presented to him. Well, the church is going to be set apart, and it's going to be cleansed. But one day, there's going to be a wedding take place. And in that wedding, that bride is not going to have a spot anywhere on her. There's not going to be anything on that garment. Now, I guarantee you, if you ladies, when you're thinking back on your wedding, and you think about the dress that you had on, and all of a sudden, if there would have been a big spot somewhere, you would have freaked out, wouldn't you? Don't lie and say, oh, it wouldn't have mattered to me. If you'll lie about that, you might lie about something else. All right? Jesus said he wants to present to himself a glorious church, not having spot or a wrinkle. Can I tell you that churches right now have spots and wrinkles? We really do. We've got spots because we don't always live right. We got wrinkles because we don't always walk and talk and sit right. But there's going to come a time when Jesus has got all of those spots gone and all of those wrinkles ironed out, and when he presents that bride of Christ, those people that are truly born again, oh, it's going to be a glorious bride. And it's going to be something that is a beauty to behold. It's going to be holy. There's not going to be sin anywhere. Now, in this congregation this morning, there's sin. You say, well, how do you know that? Because you got a sinner in the pulpit. Just like there's sinners in the pew. But there's going to come a time when the Lord presents us and we're not going to have a blemish anywhere. It's going to be holy and it's going to be glorious. Well, let me give you another thing, and my time's just about gone. What should be our attitude toward the church? Our attitude toward the church. Well, I guess what we need to do is we need to get a biblical definition of what a church is. The word church is a word that comes from a Greek word called ekklesia. And it means it's a called out assembly. It is a group of people that have been called out and they have bonded together for a specific purpose and they have a set of specific beliefs. And so you have churches that are called out all over the place. One of these days, when the Lord comes back, there's going to be a calling out where God's people from all around this globe are going to be called out, and He's going to have one huge church. But right now, that church is made up of local assemblies around the world. A few weeks ago, I preached in Puerto Rico. I was at a local assembly in Puerto Rico. When I have been to Israel, I have been to churches and assemblies where people would get together and they would be a church there in Israel. First time I went, I met with a couple of different churches. When I preached in Barbados, when I preached in Mexico, I have gone to local assemblies. In other states here in America where I have preached, I've gone to local assemblies and preached at those places. They are local. You are looking at a preacher that believes in the local church. You have example after example after example in the Word of God of local assemblies. You've got churches plural in Galatia. What is Galatia? Galatia is an area. It's not a specific city, it's an area. So you've got multiple churches in an area, all right? What about at Corinth? You've got people that are at the church of Corinth. You've got people that are at the church at Rome. You've got people that are at the church of Thessalonica. You've got people that are in the seven churches of Asia Minor. You've got all of the various churches and their specific locations that they are at. Now, I'm not a big universal church type guy, all right? Now, there's going to come a time when that church is going to be pulled together. But right now, we're a local church. And in Loganville, Georgia, there are many congregations, Corinth being one of those. And so, what is a church? What should be our attitude toward church? We ought to love the church. Can I tell you that I love this church more than I love any other church? Now, there are some other good churches around, and I could begin to call names, but can I tell you that for me, I love this place and I have for 40 years? This is my place. I like this place, and I hope you like this place and love this place. And I hope you'll tell other people that you like it and you love it. And let's fill it up, all right? Let's do it for the glory of God. And so we've got a local place that we come together. We don't say, well, you know what I want to do? I'm just gonna skip the Sunday deal, and I'm just going to worship God myself in my own little place up in the mountains. That sounds great with today's thinking. But can I tell you, if you are a member of a church, do you know what the picture is? It's the picture of a body. Now, when we think of membership, we think of having our name on a piece of paper. But that's not the biblical picture of a member. The biblical picture of a member comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And what is that picture? It's the picture of a body. All right? What happens if you're making a cabinet, all right? You got a you got a table saw out. And you're cutting a piece of board. And you push that board through, and your phone rings, and you're not paying attention, and all of a sudden you push that thing through, and you don't use a guide once you get close to that saw, and you cut your thumb off. You know what you've been, you know what just happened? You've been dismembered. That's not a joke. That's what's happened. You've got a member that's cut off from the body. And yet, on the membership of the Corinth Baptist Church, we got all kind of people that are dismembered. We got some folks that the FBI can't find. All right? You know, that is a joke if you want to laugh there. All right. But we're a body. And if the body, if we don't work together, it doesn't function right. Just absolutely does not function right. I was, it just got brought up just a moment ago. Miss Irene mentioned this to me. Over in their subdivision, my son had bought a house when he was 21 years old. And that's when I broke my leg, was walking down about 125 or 150 yards behind his house, down by a little creek area. And I tried to hop a little mud puddle that was not more than about 2 or 3 feet wide. But when I hit the other side, my feet went out from under me because of the mud. And when my foot hit, it kind of torqued it and snapped my tibia bone. Can I tell you that when that bone broke, my body did not function right? My foot was not pointing that way. My foot was pointing that way. And I finally got a chance to crawl out and drove home with my left leg. Got a shower and called my wife, and she said, "Are you sure it's broken?" I said, "Oh, it's broke. If I'm looking and that thing's pointing that way instead of that way, it's broke." You know, and I'd look back when I was crawling, it'd just flop. You know what? It wasn't functioning right. And when we have church members and they get dismembered, the church doesn't function right. What does Jesus want? He wants a church that functions right. He wants a church that has been sanctified. He wants a church that doesn't have spot nor wrinkle. And he's working on that. And so, it's a picture of a body. And can I say that I believe that the scriptures teach that we ought to be a member of a church? Now, there's not a verse that says, "Thou shalt be a member of the Corinth Baptist Church." I wish there were, but there's not. But you can't read the Bible and not see that membership is important. Does anybody in here know the first mention of the word church in the New Testament? Matthew 16, verse 18. Jesus told Peter, "Thou art Peter, you're a little rock. But upon this rock, me, I will build my church." The word church there and will is future tense. The second time that the word church is mentioned is found two chapters later in Matthew chapter 18. So, in other words, from sometime between 16 and 18 of the Gospel of Matthew, something happens. In Matthew 18, it says this: "If a brother sins, you go and you talk to that brother. If he listens, wonderful, you've reclaimed him. If he will not listen, you take another witness with you and you too go and you talk to him. And if he repents, great. But if he does not, you know what the third thing you do is? You bring him before the church." There's church discipline that's there. How can you have church discipline without being a member? There's no authority. So between 16 and 18, evidently the organization was put in place. Now, I believe that the power came in Acts chapter 2. That's when the Holy Spirit came and started indwelling people. But when you have church discipline, like 1 Corinthians 5, Acts 5, all of those things, it's predicated on the fact that these people were members of the church. You've got the one in Acts chapter 5, you got a husband and his wife, Ananias and Sapphira, church at Jerusalem, that's where they were members. You've got 1 Corinthians, church at Corinth, that's where the man who was being immoral with his stepmother, that's where their membership was at. And in both of those situations, church discipline was involved. I'll give you another one. What about Hebrews 13? In Hebrews 13, it says, obey them that have the rule over you. They watch for your souls. In other words, your pastor, the staff, wherever your membership is at, you ought to listen to their admonishments, listen to their preaching. Why? Because they have the authority over you. Now you say, well, I don't want nobody having authority over me. Well, everybody's got authority of some kind. Somebody says, you know, well, I don't have anybody tell me what to do. All right, well, I'll tell you what you do. Get on the other side of Loganville, going toward Monroe or past Monroe, and go about 85 miles an hour down that road and see if somebody's got authority on you. There's the times when I have been driving from my house maybe to go to Athens, and there'd be three or four cars pulled over by the Georgia State Patrol or by the Walton County Sheriff's Department or the Oconee County Sheriff's Department or the Clark County Sheriff's Department. You know what they had? They had authority over somebody. And if you don't pay your fine, somebody's going to come get you with some more authority. They're going to have a gun. And you're going to pay that fine or you're going to go to the pokey. You say, well, I'm my own man. Nobody tell me what to do. Let me tell you something. Somebody's going to tell you what to do. I don't care who you are. You say, I got my own business. I can make my own decisions, yeah? And if you don't listen to your customers, you're not going to have a business. And it doesn't matter if you're a preacher or not. Even preachers are under the authority of people. You're under the authority of the church, but ultimately you're under the authority of God, and He's going to hold preachers doubly accountable. That scares me to death, knowing that I'm going to be twice as responsible as you. And so we've got the scriptures that teach membership. And I believe that membership is important for growth and maturity. It's tough, tough, tough to grow all by yourself. But when you got a group together, or get a group together, and you can begin to talk with each other, and you begin to let iron sharpen iron, the next thing you know, there's some maturity that begins to take place. And you may think something totally goofy, but you may have a couple of people that are able to take you, just like Aquila and Priscilla did, and teach them in the way. In other words, sometimes lay people can take young preachers and show them things, and they go, wow, I've never seen that before. Growth, maturity, spirituality, I believe that it comes in a church setting a lot better than in a mountain house. I believe that it comes a lot, lot better than hanging out on a beach. Now, are beaches fun? Yeah. Yeah. Last time I went to the beach, I got woke up. Greenpeace was trying to roll me in the ocean. Okay. I'll let that sink in, and some of you will start laughing whenever you go get your hamburger at lunch. I love the beach. I like walking on it. Don't care about sitting in the sun. I like walking at night early in the morning. All right? I like the mountains. But I'm going to tell you, neither of those take the place of church. Sunday is the Lord's day. We ought to want to come to church. It's God's place. I close with this. God's always had a place. He had a place in the Garden of Eden. What did he see? He said, Adam, where art thou? In other words, they had a place where they met. When the people of Israel needed a place to meet early on, where did they meet? God had them build a tent called a tabernacle. Later on, God let them build a building. David brought the supplies and Solomon built the structure. And so they had a temple to meet. And in the New Testament, God's got a place. It's called the church. Now, let me just say this. The church is not this building. The church is you. But there's something about it when we come together corporately that is pleasing to the Lord. And I'm going to tell you, there's going to come a day when we are coming together corporately in one big church. But until then, let's be faithful at our church, the local church. Let's love the church the way Jesus did. Let's love it. Let's make people feel special. Let's be unselfish. Let's share. How do we prove that? By giving to each other sacrificially, by giving to the church monetarily sacrificially, by helping missionaries financially and sacrificially. And then the world can look from the outside and go, wow, there's something different about those folks. That's a church that's different right there. May that be the testimony in our community. Let's stand together. Thank you so much for listening this morning.